I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. I just wanted to let you know that this episode of Vermont Edition has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Late Monday night, Governor Phil Scott ended a six-week stalemate with Democratic leaders over property tax rates. Scott announced that he would let the third budget plan proposed by the Democrats become law without his signature, rather than have the state face a government shutdown this weekend. Scott says when the Senate rejected two compromise plans developed by House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and the governor last Friday night, it was clear to him that a government shutdown was becoming a real possibility. And Scott says that was an outcome he could not accept under any circumstances.
As governor, I could not put the health and safety of Vermonters or the stability of our economy at risk. While I do not support raising any tax rates in a year we have a $55 million surplus, and growing, I felt this debate had gone as far as it could responsibly go, leaving me with no choice but to allow it to become law without my signature.
The governor says the debate over this issue is by no means over. He plans to continue to work to, quote, better manage state spending on education, and he wants to control future education budget growth. So how could these education issues affect spending in the future, and certainly campaign 2018? With us now to take a look at these questions are a group of reporters who closely follow Vermont politics. With us today, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV, and Xander Landon of VT Digger. Great to have you all here today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
And these are three people who spent an enormous amount of time covering issues at the State House this session and did a lot of excellent stories on a wide range of issues. We're very pleased to have them with us today. So as we look at this final budget agreement, it seems to give both sides some of the things they were fighting for. The governor got the Democrats to agree to not raise the statewide residential property tax rate, to implement a statewide health care contract for teachers, and to get them to look at making changes in student-staff ratios. In return, the Democrats got the governor to agree to raise the non-residential rate by 4.5 cents. They blocked consideration of bigger penalties for high-spending towns. And there will be just a study of ways to examine increasing student-staff ratios in many schools across Vermont. Senator Tim Ashe told me he thought the agreement was a true compromise because both sides had to make some concessions.
I think that both sides are outside of their comfort zones, which is the sign of a compromise. And I'm just glad that the governor agreed with us that we shouldn't have a government shutdown and that people can breathe easy and know that come this weekend, state government will still be open.
So, April, is this a case where both sides got something in it? Senator Ashe was saying, you know, this is how a compromise works.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. A couple things that weren't included in that list you just read off. The legislature also did get, I think, about $15 million toward paying down the teacher pension liability, obligation, which was something that really was important to them. And the governor didn't get his five-year plan set in stone that we would have a loan from the education from the general fund to the education fund. So there were a couple things also that kind of were in the air that that's how they played out. I think it kind of ended just because they were out of time. It didn't really seem like the governor was necessarily on board. He wasn't on board with what the Senate and the House came out with, but they forced him to accept just because of there wasn't really any time left. It was basically a choice in the end between accepting some tax increase and a shutdown, which would have been catastrophic. And I think that's not really a choice in the end for the governor.
And April, a government shutdown would have been really bad for both sides, mm-hmm. Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, at the press conference this week, the governor acknowledged that he thought that the blame would have fallen on him, which I think is fair. He's the face of state government. And the governor, his administration didn't have contingency plans, or at least not any that they were willing to share with lawmakers or the public. So I don't think it was a real possibility. I mean, it was a possibility, but I think practically it wasn't a possibility.
So, Neil, some people might be wondering, you know, why did it take 6 weeks for them to come to this compromise? Was it a matter, as April was saying, that they had to be staring down at a government shutdown and that was really the trigger?
Yeah, I mean, absent the July 1st new fiscal year, we'd still be trying to find out what the latest ideas and compromises were that would be on the table. You know, but this is – it's a corner that the governor backed himself into. You don't typically hear politicians give declarative statements like, I will never sign something that includes X, Y, or Z, because, you know, it in the U.S. we have – legislative systems. We don't have dictators, and one person can't say exactly what the situation is going to be. And so the governor found himself in a position where he, as April said, he simply ran out of time. He could not take it any further because he acknowledged at the news conference on Thursday that the public would look to him. And let's not forget that the governor created this mess in the first place by vetoing a budget over a dispute that had nothing really to do with the budget. So it's sort of a crisis, a manufactured crisis that the governor realized he had to end.
Sander, how do you think the public views this issue? Do you think folks out there are thinking, well, they finally got a compromise, they avoided the government shutdown, that's good? Or are they maybe thinking, what on earth is happening at the State House? Has the legislative process become dysfunctional?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I think it's something that we'll see play out in the campaign rhetoric and in you know, when voters head to the polls in the fall. Nothing like this has really happened where we've seen the imminent threat of a government shutdown. The last time we've seen something similar to this, you know, was really in 1961 when the lawmakers made an emergency appropriation to sort of hash out a budget disagreement into the next month of the fiscal year. So this is sort of a little bit of uncharted territory. And I'm not sure, you know, how closely the public has been following this, but there certainly was a lot of concern from state employees over this shutdown threat. That definitely got a lot of public attention on their end. But, you know, in the end, like, you know, we've all been saying, this is a you know, pretty clear compromise that was reached. And how, you know, the public perceives it, I think, will be sort of left to – we'll be left to see, you know, in the elections.
Let's turn to John, who is calling from Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Bob. A couple things. First of all, you know, this was an argument over what to do with record – surplus revenue and whether to raise property taxes at a time when we have record surplus. Some of the interesting things that came out of this impasse were that the legislature has underfunded teachers' pensions for years and has been irresponsible about that. The other thing that came up was that the Ed Fund does not represent simply K through 12 spending at school budgets, but a whole host of other programs since Shumlin allowed more programs to be funded by the Ed Fund. So positively, you know, and then the final thing was Democratic Representative Cynthia Browning, who has a PhD in economics, pointed out that the Act 46 incentives were never funded and actually were paid for by the school property taxes they were supposed to reduce. So there's been a lot of shenanigans going on that this budget process has brought to light. And hopefully in the next session, and we start out with a hole in the education fund, primarily because there's still well over $20 million in programs not funded by K-12 education and no funding for Act 46 incentives. And that's been really important that this news has come to light during this budget process, because if we're going to solve things, we actually have to know who's paying for them and what the costs are.
Okay, John, we appreciate your phone call very much. Let's turn to Scott, who is calling from Barrie City. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Vermont is one of four states that taxes Social Security. And I thought that there was some legislation to phase that out, but I lost track of it in the different iterations of budgets. Is that still in there, or what's the status of that?
All right. I see a lot of heads nodding yes. April?
Yeah, that was included in the budget and tax bill that ultimately got through exemption up to, and I don't know if I can recite the specific income amounts, but a certain level for, you know, single tax filers and a certain level for married tax filers, joint filers. If you're up to that income threshold, the Social Security benefit will be tax exempt.
And that was something that the governor proposed very early on in the session, and that lawmakers actually wanted to phase in. You know, they liked the idea and they wanted to phase it in actually at a faster pace. So the governor had proposed phasing that in over 3 years, and they put it in place just to start in the next fiscal year, so this coming year.
Neil, it seems like a month ago, but at last Friday, at this time, there was a thought at the State House that there was a deal. There was an agreement between House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and Governor Phil Scott, and they worked on that, and it was going to phase in a non-residential property tax cut over a two-year period rather than one. And then Senate leaders came in and said, no way. There's no way we're agreeing to this.
Right.
Are we seeing a lack of communication between the House and Senate over this issue?
I mean, a little bit, yeah. But there was also, I mean, it was a pretty bold move for the Speaker to step forward and begin negotiating with the governor directly and trying to get a deal in place. I mean, you can understand why the Speaker would want to do that and try to get some kind of negotiated settlement rather than jam something through. It turns out what she worked on with the governor wasn't palatable to the Senate. The governor has, I think, enjoyed being able to say that, you know, the Senate came in and blew up a deal and the Speaker walked away from a deal. I mean, how much you can call it a deal when all three parties aren't on board is one thing. But also, let's, you know, if we're talking about breaking deals, what about all of the Republicans that voted for a budget and then walked away from it to stand with the governor and not override a veto? So there are a lot of blame and broken deals and walking away from things all around.
And what you're speaking of is the number of Republicans. What about a half of the Republican House caucus voted for the budget the first time around?
Oh, it was an overwhelming vote, more than enough to override the veto. And, you know, you have to ask them, perhaps, well, didn't you break a deal, you know, to help the governor? So it's, you know, I think we should all stop talking about deals that were never deals and just, you know, understand that it's a legislature and a governor and there's politics involved, and that's where we're at.
And Xander, the Senate had an amazing vote on the budget, on the third budget. It was 27-0,
right.
And you had the Senate Minority Leader, Joe Benning, get up and say on the Senate floor, "Governor, you ought to sign this budget." I mean, that was a remarkable statement.
Yeah, and I think that the Senate leadership was aware that, you know, they sort of had the foresight to see that Scott was backed, the governor was backed into a corner. There really wasn't any more compromise that they needed to put on the table to get him to sign or agree to let this budget become law and end the impasse. And they were steadfast. They didn't want to use any more one-time money, surplus money, to buy down tax rates. That's something that that Democratic leadership has been, you know, steadfastly opposed to doing, or, you know, has been extremely reluctant to do since the beginning of the session. The idea is if you use one-time money to buy down tax rates, you lead to a larger problem in the next year. You're putting off an inevitable tax increase, and you're actually exacerbating the tax increase. So they strategized clearly that that wasn't something that they were willing to do, and it wasn't something that they had to do to get this to end the impasse and have him, you know, agree to sign a budget or let it become law.
In April, the Democrats said, this is exactly what happened last year, and we're not going to do this 2 years in a row. You know, we've been fooled once, but not twice.
Right. Part of the tax increase that would have happened this year was because of last year's decisions and the deal that they worked out with the governor last year. So, yes, that was there was definitely caution. Of course, in the end, they did end up using $20 million of one-time money to buy down the tax rate. But And it wasn't just Democrats, I should mention. Randy Brock in the Senate was someone who said he wasn't comfortable with using – with putting even a greater hole in the Ed Fund next year. He was not comfortable with going any further, and that contributed to that unanimous vote in the Senate. In the House, Scott Beck stood up, who's a Republican lawmaker who works a lot on tax issues, and said, this is irresponsible. We know it's bad policy. Why are we doing it? And he actually proposed something that would have – raise the tax rates to what they would have needed to be without any one-time money. So it is a bipartisan concern. Democrats lean more heavily on that argument this year.
One question is whether or not this six-week stalemate was really about a couple of cents on the statewide property tax rate, or did it reflect a much larger debate? Well, former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis said the dispute is really about whether the state or local school boards should make key education decisions in the future.
The governor, and even more so people on his staff, would like to see a centralization of those decisions in Montpelier. I think many of them would like over time to see some of the small schools around the state close. And they'd like the decisions on that sort of thing to be made by the legislature passing a bill that in effect gives locally elected school boards very little choice.
Budget and Finance Commissioner Adam Gresham said the administration does not want to micromanage local school board decisions, but he says the state definitely has an interest in having, quote, better management of the $1.8 billion education fund.
It is clearly about more than money. And there is a philosophical divide here. We have no interest in making decisions about individual budget items. We have no interest in making decisions about which school stays open and which school stays closed. Those are local decisions. But we do have an interest from a statewide level of having a more active role in managing what is our largest single pool of money.
Neil, was that part of the Democrats' argument that if you use this one-time money to buy down the property tax rates, as April was saying earlier, that you would have a larger issue to deal with next year, and then perhaps some of the governor's five-year plan, the different elements of that proposal, would seem more attractive?
Well, I mean, if you create a big enough hole, then it becomes more attractive to find more drastic measures to help close that gap. But, you know, Commissioner Gresham mentioned a couple of things. They have no interest in making individual or local decisions. But if you end up moving toward a higher student-to-staff ratio, then, you know, that is a way of sort of getting your foot in the door to making local decisions. You're telling local districts that eventually you've got to have fewer staff in the building. So now you may not say, you know, little Susie's music teacher is gone, but you're going to force those decisions, even though you're not spelling out exactly what they have to be.
And he also mentioned we have no interest in deciding which schools close, but the administration actually did float a school closure commission early in the year. It didn't go anywhere, and there wasn't a lot of attention, I think, to it because the governor didn't include it. It disappeared. Yeah. He didn't really press it. But that was part of what they were talking about.
Right.
They see that this is a big expenditure of state government and big part of the economy.
And that's also the beauty of the governor floating his 18 trial balloons and then walking away from all of it and saying, well, we put some ideas on the table, never having to own up to anything, because I'm sure that particular one that April just referenced would be extremely unpopular in rural communities.
Yeah.
We got a number of remarks on Facebook, one from Mark in White River Junction, who said after the budget impasse, we need more Republicans to stand up to the tax and spend progressives, to which Kristen in Bennington responded, the budget impasse didn't change how I'll vote. It's reinforcing how I'll vote. We need a governor willing to work with the legislature. We also got an email from James and a similar comment from Fontana that the non-residential property tax rate includes cottages, camps, and second homes which residents own in Vermont. It also includes rental properties in which there are approximately 75,000 rental units in Vermont and thousands of people who rent those homes, and that these residents, many of whom are the poorest folks in Vermont, will all probably have their rents increased as landlords usually pass along the cost of the increase in their property taxes. James concluded, These facts have not been part of this year's debate. Politicians and the press often imply that only businesses and flatlanders pay the non-residential property tax rate. Sandra, would it be fair to say that the governor looks at the $1.7, $1.8 billion education budget and says, that's enough money? At his press conference yesterday that you and I were both at, he was saying that, gee, if you gave people $1.8 billion and said, design a system K through 12, you would not end up with what we have now.
Yeah, and I think that the Scott administration is seeing smaller student numbers at the schools, and you know they say that you know we basically there's some flexibility here. We can limit the number of staff members at our schools, and that's a large way that we can reap savings in the future. Part of this 5-year plan that he had proposed included basically a plan to encourage districts to help schools reduce the number of their staff members by not replacing positions that are lost to attrition. Basically, the argument is that with, you know, the smaller school sizes, student sizes, populations, there's a lot of room for saving. So I think that that was sort of the basis of the argument for you know, and the how they were banking a lot of this money that could come in. But Democrats were really concerned about the projected savings in that plan that had been laid out. They were saying, you know, you're not mandating any schools to actually reduce their staff sizes. So how are you actually going to save the money here? So that was a big part of this debate, you know, throughout the session.
Let's turn to Chris, who's calling from Hardwick. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, I have a comment about the tax on non-resident property. I'm a retired pensioner. I have a property in Hardwick, and I spend most of the year in another state. And I think when the legislature taxes non-residents, they do it because obviously we're an easy target. We don't have a vote. But many of us, there are many pensioners, many retired people who have second homes in Vermont, and we are economically challenged as well. And I expect that many of us will decide that it's no longer feasible to remain in Vermont. So I would think that they are actually killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. And I'd like your comments about that.
All right, Chris, thanks very much for your phone call. Neil?
Well, look, I mean, we had the Facebook comment from somebody mentioning nobody talks about this. Well, the governor certainly did. If anyone listening together to the governor would know that about 60% of the non-residential property taxpayers are Vermonters. It's something he's talked about a lot, and I'm sure something we've all mentioned in our stories as well. But I think part of the problem is we call it residential and non-residential, and that's sort of misleading.
Yeah.
It's the homestead tax rate and then everything else, essentially. If you don't live full-time in that property, it's the non-residential rate, and I think that's where part of the it's easy to sort of pass it off as maybe people thinking it's just out-of-staters or whatever else, but it is a large portion of Vermonters.
And I think that there was even a proposed amendment to change the name of the non-residential property tax rate just to highlight and make that more clear.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people do maybe see that word, read that word, and think this is only applying to folks who own a second home in Vermont. Maybe mm-hmm. they're from New York or New Jersey. They have a second home, and those are the people that are paying this tax. But really, it is a large, you know, portion of Vermonters.
Yeah.
At his press conference yesterday, the governor made it very clear that he intends to continue his efforts to, quote, better manage the education budget. And a key part of that is this plan we've been talking about to increase student-staff ratios in Vermont.
We spend $1.7 billion to educate about 73,000 to 76,000 students, 30,000 fewer than 20 years ago. So that's the problem. And when you look at the $1.7 billion, 80% of that is in labor. So it would lead you to believe that there has to be a means of increasing those ratios.
Now, Nicole Mace is the executive director of the Vermont School Boards Association, and she says if controlling education spending is really the governor's goal, then there ought to be a healthy debate about the governor's plan.
The only way the state can guarantee level tax rates is to take direct control over school spending decisions. And so if that's the role that the governor is interested in having the state take on, I think that's a very different policy discussion and political discussion to have with Vermonters than I'm here to keep your taxes level.
April, what do you think? Is this going to be a debate that's going to carry over into the next legislative session and there is a bigger issue here that needs to be considered?
I think so. I mean, well, the governor has said that he's going to continue fighting for tax relief, beyond this point. So I don't know if that means that he's going to insist on level tax rates again next year. But certainly this will still be in the air if he's still governor. And he will continue, I would think, to have a concern about school spending. And what Nicole Mace had said is the same thing that I heard from the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Ann Cummings. She said if the governor wants to have more centralization of power over school budgets, he should just lay that out. And it's a political risk to bring that discussion up. But that's, I think, what a lot of some observers are seeing in this effort this year, and they want to see it more explicitly debated next year.
I think that's the key point that Nicole Mace mm-hmm. makes and others like Senator Cummings. Mm-hmm. If you really want to save property tax dollars in the future, you cannot allow local decision-making anymore. It really has to be driven by Montpelier because historically, we've seen local districts believe that they're doing the right thing when they support their local budgets. And there's a reason that politicians don't go around the state telling people, hey, Montpelier is going to take over for you. Thanks, but we'll take it from here. It's extremely unpopular. We saw the governor in the form of Commissioner Gresham briefly float a plan for staff-to-student ratio that would sort of force the matter, and that disappeared within a day or two, I think, because it's really politically, not feasible to sell that to Vermonters. And until a governor and a legislature are on the same page and willing to have that difficult conversation with Vermonters and tell them, like, hey, maybe the system isn't working the way we want it to, and now we're going to take over. Good luck with that.
And I think something else that we'll continue to see in years to come until maybe there's a solution to this problem is the debate over, well, who needs to own this property tax increase if we're seeing one. What the Scott administration had been saying is that, when people were voting on their budgets, they weren't voting for a tax increase, this is something that, the state has to take care of. Democrats were much more willing to say when people vote their, school district budget at town meetings, they're aware of what they're doing. If they vote for an increase, they know that they're voting for a tax increase. So that's a debate, that has been playing out for years and probably will continue to see.
In April, is the governor really trying to thread a very fine line of saying we've got to deal with these student staff ratios, but I don't want to mandate it? But it has to happen if we're going to save it. So in a way, it seems like he's saying, Vermont has, I think, one of the lowest student staff ratios in the country. Mm-hmm. And that if you increased it by one or two, there are hundreds of millions of dollars that could be saved. But that means a lot of teachers are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, well, the administration would say you can do it through attrition so that people don't have to actually lose their jobs, but just don't fill the vacancies. I'm sure it would play out differently in every school if it were to come to that. But so the administration did, obviously, we just talked about float a mandate. I think the challenge, not only the political challenge of that, but also just nobody really knows why the ratio, I think, is so low. And that's part of what this task force is going to be looking at going forward now, looking at what optimum ratio there should be. Is it that we have a low ratio because our students are really needy and they need additional support and there's services beyond just classroom teachers that we've had to put in the schools to make sure that students have what they need to learn? There are a lot of questions about why do some school districts have a really low ratio and some a really high ratio? Nobody could answer those questions when this first came up this year. And those are really crucial questions. So if we're going to have that debate, we need to have those answers first.
And Neil, it's very important to underscore, we're talking about the student-staff ratio, not student-teacher ratio, because I actually think the number of teachers in Vermont has declined over the last 10 years.
And April made a really, really great point. We're talking about we need to understand what are the needs of the students here in Vermont. Do we have lots of additional people in Vermont schools because students need more one-on-one time or have special needs? Or what is the situation? Do we just have, you know, too many people serving lunch at noon? Mm-hmm. We don't know the answers to these really crucial questions, and it's really hard to make policy if policymakers don't even know the basic facts.
Let's talk to John in Richmond. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Bob. My concern is in this whole discussion, just in the on your program, there's been no discussion of education quality. It's like we're looking at the sticker price on a car, and we're just trying to figure out what the monthly payment's going to be. It doesn't matter whether we get a Yugo or a Lexus. And I think there's a lack of firm goals as to what we're going to provide with education. There's a lack of leadership from both the legislature and the governor to do that. I happen to live in a district where our staff to student ratio is above his recommended levels, yet we're a high performing school by whatever standards are currently in place. You can't have it both ways. You've got to set the standards that evaluate everyone in a uniform manner, make sure that they're not subjective. And then you use the whole group to figure out how to achieve those. It's great to hear that they're finally have a commission starting looking at this, but districts have been doing well for a long time. What are they doing right? Is anybody talking to them? It's frustrating.
Yeah, John, you raise a very good point, and it'll be interesting to see if this commission does look at those areas where the school districts feel like they're doing a good job and if there's something to be learned for other school districts around the state. We appreciate your phone call very much. Let's turn to Colin in Wethersfield. Hi, Colin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for having me on. Sort of full disclosure, I am a UVM Graduate School of Education graduate. I taught in Chittenden County for a number of years at like your previous caller said, a high-performing school. I'm now down in the sort of eastern side of the state in the Upper Valley. And I wondered if your commentators could, talk a little bit to the listening public perhaps about a topic that I think has sort of been missed in the discussion, perhaps even at the legislature. I do happen to teach history, so I remember a lot of the earlier policies of the Douglas administration around teacher retirement and pensions and ages for qualifying for your retirement benefits. And the system was pretty drastically altered, if my memory serves correct. And it became a policy of, the aggregate of your last 5 years of service. And Neil Lunderville also cooked up the idea of the rule of 90. So your age plus your years of service had to equal 90. And I know the discussions within schools, I was privy to those, among some of the more veteran staff, all of whom, had done a lot of service for the young people of Vermont. Mm-hmm. That kept them in the teaching ranks for a much longer time than perhaps they had anticipated.
Okay.
For us younger teachers, I started in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001. That, of course, projected, a fairly long term of service as well, perhaps longer.
Okay, Colin, we appreciate your phone call. You made a very good point. Neil, the teachers who have been there for 25 or 30 years are certainly earning a lot more money than the ones who are coming in first year, second year, third year. So if there is attrition, are there savings there that school districts might enjoy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anytime older longer serving teachers retire, they're going to be making more than the newest teachers. But you know, as great as solving this crisis through attrition sounds, you know, sometimes you don't need a social studies teacher to retire. You need an English teacher to retire. And it sounds great for the administration or anyone else to say, oh, we'll take care of it through attrition. Well, it's just, you know, I'd be surprised if it all broke exactly the way they needed to.
Sandra, I'm wondering, do you think that this issue has an impact on the gubernatorial race in November and how the Democratic candidates are looking at it? And does this become a focal point for them?
You know, I think it might in the House races. In the House races, the stakes are kind of high this year, maybe higher than they are in the gubernatorial race, where the odds are pretty likely that Governor Scott will see re-election. In the House races, there's a lot more uncertainty, and there's also the interest of Democrats in gaining more seats so that they have more influence in the House. This year, the Republican caucus in the House has more than one-third of the body. So they were able basically to sustain and assist the governor in his veto priorities. So when, you know, the minimum wage bill was vetoed, they were able to sustain that. When the two budget vetoes came down, they were able to sustain that. So Democrats are definitely have a vested interest in gaining more seats. And I think we'll see rhetoric on both sides coming out of this impasse. We'll see Democrats saying that they tried to chart a path to fiscal responsibility in buying down the teacher pension debt and in trying to prevent, you know, the use of one-time money to pay down an ongoing expense. And I think we'll see Republicans say that they fought tooth and nail to prevent a tax increase in a responsible way on their end.
April, was interesting. Yesterday at the governor's press conference, he was asked whether or not this whole issue demonstrates the need to elect more Republicans to the Vermont House and Senate. And his reaction was, well, we don't want to lose anymore, which I thought was interesting. And also, I don't know the exact numbers, but I want to say that there are in the low 60s, 61, 62, 63 Republican candidates in the House. Now, if your goal is to get to 76 and you've only got 62 candidates, now I understand that some candidates can be added after the primary through a party system, a petition system, but it would seem like the Republicans are having a hard time putting up a strong front here.
Right. The numbers right now don't look like certainly that they could take control of the House. Their battle is, as the governor phrased it, in not losing seats. They want to keep at least 50-51 seats so that they can uphold the governor's veto if the governor is Phil Scott again next year. And that's really, I think, what their focus is, even though I'm sure they would like to have more seats. I think the more realistic goal is just to prevent losses.
And when you talk to rank-and-file House members, GOP House members, there isn't a lot of optimism that they're going to be able to do that. I think a lot of them look at the big picture here in Vermont with an anti-Trump sort of midterm election coming, and they're looking at mid to high 40s in their view, and that's disappointing to them.
I think, though, that the House Republicans did see a win in just the fact that we prevented a government shutdown by getting a solution on the table. In the caucus of the House Republicans a couple of weeks ago, there was actually a lot of anxiety over the fact that there was a shutdown threat on the table. They said a few members were saying, you know, a shutdown never looks good on Republicans, no matter how you spin it, basically concerned that if a shutdown did happen, the blame would land on them sort of inadvertently, whether it was actually their fault or not. That's where it would land.
Yeah, and I think that fear was there because so many of them walked away from the budget that they once supported. It's a rational thought.
Right.
In the end, it's sort of a moot point because they were able to get something into law.
Let's get a quick call in from Sarita in Colchester. Hi, Sarita. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling as a former teacher, school counselor, and school board member. in Williston, not Colchester.
Okay.
I moved to Colchester a couple of years ago. But my question or concern is, why is Governor Scott waiting until the last 2 weeks of the legislative session to discuss, to me, one of the most complicated and expensive expenditures of, you know, the budget? That it's more the process that I'm concerned with. I mean, I think we need to have this conversation, and as Nicole said, we have to look at the trade-offs. You know, do we want lower taxes and maybe give up some local control? But I think that's a huge conversation for Vermonters.
April, again, a lot of things came up at the press conference yesterday. The governor was asked about this question as well, and his defense is, hey, last year I put a plan out there, and everybody said, hey, it's dead on arrival. So he said, I thought I'd try something else.
Yeah, and this year his attempt was put out a bunch of ideas early on, kind of let them sit, and when they didn't get anywhere, and then at the end to come out with a new plan that also didn't go anywhere, really. Well, he got pieces of it, but as a whole comprehensive plan, it didn't go through. You know, I don't know if I can speak to the strategy from within the governor's office. It's certainly something that the legislature is frustrated with. They feel like they can't fully vet these really complicated topics in the time that the governor has given them, and it's led to some frustration and, I don't know, just a tense relationship this year.
Xander, we're almost out of time, but we are going to see the creation of a statewide health care contract for teachers coming up in the next few years.
That's right, and that was sort of a big point of contention last year, sort of leading to the budget disagreement. This year we saw that put into place. That was part of the plan, part of the five-year plan that the governor had pitched, where we was talking about, you know, the staff-to-student ratio increase. This was something that lawmakers included as part of this compromise. This is another way. This was another give that the governor got, and he can, you know, take it, walk away saying that there's another win for him. So that was a significant part of the deal.
We'll be following these issues as they come up during the campaign. That is our program for today. Many thanks to our panel, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Xander Landon of VT Digger, and Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV. Thank you all very much for being on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Bob.